This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This program contains themes of an adult nature. Word for Word is an in-depth look into the lives of real people, which means this episode may contain explicit accounts of real-life events, including alcohol and drug use. The language used at times may cause some offence, but has been left uncensored due to the accuracy of the story. No offence is intended, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation, this is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome, family and friends, fans and fiends, to today's edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I am Benjamin Norris, and it's simply a delight to continue to work on this show for the Joy Network, which has already featured some of the community's strongest voices. In the tradition of this ongoing program, I continue to look at powerful stories and insights into the life and lifestyle of some incredible people. Each week, we will chat with those in and around our community who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community of Australia. Today's guest is one of them. This man was born in China, and when his mother met an Aussie sailor, she moved her whole family to Perth, Western Australia. However, the transition from Chinese culture was anything but smooth, and what would take place would become the foundation to the award-winning feature film titled The Home Song Stories. With a strong grasp on storytelling and a proven intellect, he later combined his skills and followed his passion of cinema and television. Winning awards for his writing and directing, this internationally recognised filmmaker made a name for himself with films like Walking on Water with Vince Colosimo, Cut Snake with Sullivan Stapleton, and The Turning, which was based on short stories by author Tim Winton. However, it was the forming of Matchbox Pictures that has seen him create popular television programs like The Slap, Barracuda, Nowhere Boys, Glitch, and even The Family Law. And with his new deal with NBC Universal and his production company Tap, we are set to see more brilliant stories being made by this extremely talented man. I'd like to welcome you, and I'd like to welcome Tony Ayres to Word for Word.
I was born in Macau. We lived in the Housing Commission flats in the back of Chinese restaurants.
Award-winning writer, director and producer Tony Ayres brought us, among other things, The Slap and much more recently Glitch.
I was probably aware at an early age that I had to protect myself.
If everyone has one story which defines them, then this is mine.
To write a character or for an actor to play a character, you have to understand them, and as soon as you understand someone, you hate them less. So I used to tackle myself into a doona, and I used to just tell myself a story.
We were interested in emotional stories and how art can be a way for people to express their various emotional needs.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you for coming in here.
It's a pleasure.
Am I a weirdo for saying this, but I can't get Sullivan Stapleton's bum out of my mind.
You're not the only one.
For people out there that haven't seen that, you have to go and see Cut Snake.
Yeah.
And for some reason, there was two scenes in particular at the start where he sort of walked down the road in those yellow shorts.
Yeah.
And then that scene where one of the protagonists is holding the gun and he sort of shifts his bum.
Yeah.
Am I a weirdo for talking to you about this?
It's Joy.
We're talking to
It'd be
our
weird
audience.
Not to be talking.
And like the film itself, I mean, the violence was very full on. The emotion from all of the characters from this triangle was so full on. Is that one of the films that people stop you and say, good God?
Weirdly enough, of the three films that I've made, Cut Snake is probably the one that's been least seen by people, probably the least talked about. But I mean, I love it mainly because of the intensity of the performance. Sullivan, Stapleton, Alex Russell and Jester Gow, the three central characters in it. I had such a great time directing them. They're such intelligent actors. They're completely committed to, you know, this bizarre f-up love triangle. And I directed a reading of the script 2003, and then it went away for a decade, and I didn't think about it, and because it had other directors on it and went in another direction. And then I sort of randomly got a call from the producer asking me whether I was interested in looking at it again, and I said, yeah, because I loved it. And so then Blake and I worked on it together and sort of honed it into the film that it is, which is kind of like a tight three-hander love triangle with fairly intense kind of homoerotic elements to it.
There's a real sense with you, with your storytelling, that you're sort of exploring the human condition, and there's a real sense that you're watching real people. Is there a way that you can summarise how you can dig that out of people?
I guess it's always to do with the story and the script, and like Walking on Water was about a particular situation, and it was based on something true. I mean, I think one of the recurring things in my career is an attraction to true stories, the truth. Mm. Walking on Water was the writer, Roger Monk, had an experience. You know, it's not that experience, but it span off from that experience.
Sure.
And Home Song Stories is the story about my mother and my sister and me. And Cut Snake actually came from a true story, which is the film is a riff on the bombing of the Whiskey A Go-Go in Brisbane.
Really?
Yeah. And the writer basically span the whole story from one line in his research, because he was wanting to write a film about that bombing. There's one line in the research that turned into Cut Snake, which was, it was rumoured that the two men were lovers in prison.
Wow.
We don't know if it's true, but then, you know, we tried to make something true from it.
Well, you definitely got something out of that. Look, we're going to get more into your storytelling and the work that you've been able to create, but we're going to go back and sort of look at the origins of you and sort of your upbringing. Now, you were born in China.
I was born in Macau, which is on mainland China, but back then it was a Portuguese territory.
Have you ever gone back there?
Yeah. I went back a few times, especially when I was making my second film, Home Song Stories, because it was autobiographical. And we actually considered filming in Macau at one stage. And so I went back and looked at locations, and I also went back for inspiration for the script.
What can you remember before moving here to Australia? Because you moved to Perth, I think.
Yeah, I kind of came to Australia. My mother, who was like a nightclub singer, hostess at a nightclub in Hong Kong and lived in Macau, met an Australian sailor, William George Ayres, and she brought my sister and I to Australia. So he was my stepfather. That's why I'm Ayres.
And what did you know of Australia?
I guess the early days, they were coloured by two things. Coloured by being a Chinese person in a very white place. Mm. I mean, I don't even think I quite computed what that meant, because the other thing was coloured by was my mother's mental health issues. And she was an incredibly troubled woman. And, you know, she left my Australian stepfather soon after we got to Australia, and she had a string of lovers, and and we lived in the Housing Commission flats and in the back of Chinese restaurants. There's one, you know, like in the film, at one stage the family are living in the storeroom of a Chinese restaurant, and that actually was true. Like my sister, my mum and I lived in the storeroom amongst the takeaway containers and the Coke bottles and the napkins and plastic forks. And we had a bunk bed, a double bunk that my sister and I slept in, which we just went from place to place as we went from place to place. So I think that was probably, weirdly enough, my experiences of, having to confront white Australia were probably less profound for me, because I was really dealing with having to confront my mum.
And then what was that relationship like then with her? I mean, obviously she was going through severe mental health issues she was combating that. But I guess with all children, we have a yearning to interact with our parents. What kind of a relationship were you able to have?
It was a strange relationship, because I was probably aware at an early age that I had to protect myself. So I kind of kept myself at a distance. And also, back in those days, my mum, with the wisdom of hindsight, I know that my mother also did an incredible job of raising my sister and I in absolute poverty. She had no money. She couldn't even read. She worked in Chinese restaurants. And back then, it was a pretty tough environment. Like, she worked for very little pay. She worked incredibly long hours. And yet, you know, my sister and I never felt poor. We never went hungry. We always had clothes. You know, like, she did an incredible job as a provider and a protector. But because she was so emotionally unstable and erratic, I think I didn't appreciate what she was doing. And so I put a bit of a force field around myself. And also, back in those days, it was really important to integrate, to be part of Australia. So my mum didn't want me to speak Chinese. So I kind of stopped speaking Mandarin, which was my first language, when I was 3 or 4. And as a consequence, my mother and I didn't end up speaking together very much. So there was a gulf between us. But I guess my sister and I were very close, and we were a very intense, small family unit. It was pretty much the three of us until she died.
We do share this in common. My father also suffered from mental illness, and he took his own life in 2006, it was. Wow. So, like, I completely understand what it's like to lose a parent. But how old were you when that happened with your mum?
I was 11.
What happens to a boy at the age of 11 when something like that happens to your mother?
I think, you know, those memories are just burned into your, you know, retinas for, and they're kind of permanent memories. I think that, you know, often those kinds of things, they just walk with you through the rest of your life. Mm. You know, they're like scars that just actually don't, they grow over, they cover over.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever think about it consciously. I mean, for me, my way of processing all that stuff was, you know, I wrote short stories. I sort of made work. I made creative work from it. And, you know, and I made dramatic pieces about my mother and my sister and I that eventually turned into the Home Song Stories, the movie. And so that was probably the way I dealt with it. And that's also probably why, you know, how I think of it as well now.
I guess in some ways it could have been quite cathartic, I guess, for you to go back over that and explore it in your work.
Yeah.
Is that a way of being able to combat some of those lost feelings?
It also helped me learn to appreciate my mother because, you know, the woman who played my mother was Joan Chen, who's like a goddess. And we had lots of talks about that character, and she was ferociously protective of that woman. You know, she was ferociously protective of how much she cared about her children and how she was battling her demons. And weirdly enough, you know, as a director, there's part of you, you know, part of me is always so full of admiration for the actors that I work with. And so, you know, like I was so in love with Joan that I kind of fell in love with my mother.
But yeah. I think in some ways, I think even with my father, I was very angry for a very long time.
Yeah.
Because yeah. I felt like that relationship was stolen from him being very selfish.
Yeah.
So then it was quite some time before I had an aha moment where I thought to myself, oh, I didn't really appreciate what he was going through.
I mean, I suppose that's one of the, I mean, art and therapy are different things, but certainly in the process of making and understanding dramatic work, you do have to be compassionate. Like, I'm big on the idea that the dramatic arts are a compassionate form because to write a character or for an actor to play a character, you have to understand them. And as soon as you understand someone, you hate them less. That I think that's the first act of compassion. Even characters that you think are detestable, you know, when you try to dramatize them, when you try to make them real human beings, and then you get, you know, some other real human being to then pretend to be that person, that process is about trying to understand them, trying to motivation is a huge thing when you're directing an actor. You're talking about, you know, why are they doing that? You know, what's this all about? What does this mean to them? You know, who are they? And all of those things are also, ironically, the tools of therapy. They're the ways in which we can help understand each other.
I think for you in particular as well, though, it's your expression of your work is relatability. That's ultimately, I think, what you're doing. It's like you're holding up a mirror for people to see themselves.
I guess one of the things that, you know, I've always been proudest of in my work is that, you know, like my focus has tended to be on characters that are not represented very much in mainstream Australia. So, you know, like Walking on Water was about gay characters, Home Song Stories about Chinese characters. A lot of the stories, like Family Law, which I was involved in as an executive producer, is about Chinese characters. Ali's Wedding, which I was an executive producer on, is about a Muslim, you know, it's a Muslim rom-com. Barracuda was about a gay Greek swimmer. So the worlds that I tend to explore or inhabit are people on the margins of society. And what I hope to do in my work is, by presenting them to as broad an audience as possible, help, you know, us try to break down some of the preconceptions about, you know, who those people are.
Yeah, absolutely. I got asked by ABC to do You Can't Ask That.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
And I originally was like, I don't know why they want me to do this show, but I then watched one of the seasons, and it was about real people in this world being marginalized for certain things, like how they looked or things that had happened to them.
Yeah.
And that really resonated with me. But it also made me realise that I think for a lot of queer people, we have been marginalised for whatever reason at certain times in our lives, or we've felt less than. Yeah. So I think that a lot of those stories that you tell, regardless as to whether they're queer or not, you're telling stories in a space of very strong, relatable themes to gay people.
So I hope so anyway. You know, that's the best you can do. You hope that people can connect to the stories you tell. And the best chance you've got to make that connection is if you tell the stories well, if you tell them truthfully.
Mm.
And that's why truth is a big thing. Yeah, and you don't preach to people. You know, that's kind of important not to do that.
We sound like Oprah now because we're like, tell your truth. You know, if you can tell your truth to people will love it. You know, and it does seem to resonate. Talking a little bit more about your upbringing, what was your relationship like then with your sister, and sort of how did you fit into the dynamic of that relationship?
Well, my sister and I are incredibly close. I mean, we're incredibly far away. She lives in Perth and has lived in Perth her entire adult life, and I left Perth when I was 17. So we've been geographically a long way away from each other, but we speak every week and we're emotionally very close. She's just a wonderful human being, and she kind of protected me.
So then with your stepfather, you had quite a good relationship with him, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, he was an Australian sailor, and when my mum died when I was 11, he actually retired from the Navy and came back and looked after me for 3 years. And so we lived together. It was a bit of a strange relationship because he was a very laconic Caucasian Australian man. And, you know, I didn't quite know what to think of him. You know, he'd always been a shadowy figure in my childhood. But he was incredibly kind to me. And unfortunately, he passed away when I was 14, completely unexpectedly of a heart attack.
Wow.
I think when you're a child, things just happen and you just accept, well, that's just what life is. One thing I do remember, which has always stood me in good stead from the early childhood, was that, and I don't know where I got that idea, but something just popped in my head, and I just thought, I'm never going to be a victim. I'm never going to feel sorry for myself.
Still and a very powerful thing to learn. I mean, that's...
I think it's important. I think it's an important thing, because otherwise you get all blamey, and you know, you sort of feel sorry for yourself, and I think that you disempower yourself.
Yeah.
And I always felt like, oh, rightly or wrongly, you know, if I was feeling badly, there was something I could do to feel a bit better, or if I was in a difficult situation, there was something I could do to make life better. And I've always had that attitude.
I think it's a powerful thing to have learned. Was there anyone in particular that taught you not to be a victim? That taught you about looking forward?
I can't actually remember where it came from. I came from TV. I don't know. I know. It just popped into my head one day. I remember it was a particularly bad day, and I just remember having this thought, and it just stuck around. It kind of stuck around for the rest of my life.
And then you also, the relationship that you had then, was it with your carer? Was it your teacher that you had, that you fostered a relationship with?
Yeah. I had after my stepfather died, it is a real story. It's a real story. He died 2 nights before he was going to remarry. And so he was going to remarry my girlfriend's mother at the time. So it was a very kind of weird situation.
Let me break this down. So you're in a relationship with a girl back then.
Yeah, back then, my high school sweetheart.
And spoiler alert, you're a gay man now.
Yeah,
But you're in a relationship, and your mother's ex-husband is about to marry your girlfriend's mother.
Yes. It was kind of Brady Bunchy, sort of slightly, you know, we couldn't work out whether we were suddenly incestuous if they got married. And you know, because I was gay, it didn't really worry me. But, you know, it was a bit of a relief, took a certain pressure off.
Mm.
But he was going to get remarried, and 2 nights before the wedding, he had a heart attack and dropped dead. And so I moved in with my girlfriend and her mum for a year, and that was a disaster. And then I moved in with my history teacher in my final year at high school, and he was married with 2 kids, and it was, you know, he was a pretty He basically saved my life.
What's your relationship with him like these days?
That's another story.
Okay,
you know, that's okay. A full-on story. That's another full-on story.
So quite interesting, though. You lived with him, being a history teacher who was your carer, until what age?
Until I finished high school and then went to university at 17. And then I left Perth and went to Canberra, went to university. And my first year at university, I met my boyfriend, Michael. And next year, we have our 40th anniversary.
So you've been together for 40 years.
Next year, yeah. We're 39.
Too late to back out now. I love the idea of people being together for such a long time because you get to create history. I've been with my partner now for 9 years. And, you know, it's nice when you can think back. I mean, there's been things that have been sad that have happened, but things that are good.
Yeah.
And it's sort of...
It's never a straight line.
No. Yeah. But it sort of connects you together in such a powerful way.
Yeah. No, we're very bonded and he's you know, he's a film producer, so he's in the same industry, and he's about to get a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Screen Producers Association conference in the week after next. So that's very exciting.
So entwined into all of this, what age did you work out your sexuality?
Pretty young, when I was about 14, I think. I had girlfriends in high school, but I probably knew what's what, you know, like when I was about 14.
Yeah, right. And then were you able to work out sort of, were you able to be comfortable enough to tell that story to your sister? Like, what age did you come out?
The first person I told was my history teacher because I was living with him then.
Yeah.
And so I would have been 16 when I told him. And
how did that go down?
Well, he tried to play it cool and he sort of, you know, he sort of said he took me to an illegal casino to celebrate and we gambled. So it was kind of like, it was like a straight guy's version of, oh, you know, I want to show you that I'm cool about this. I'm going to show you something else that's kind of adult and a bit forbidden, like sexuality.
Like snakings. Yeah.
Like illegal casino. Wow. I had to go through these back rooms and we sort of, you know, gave me this money to gamble and it was almost like that, you know, I guess that was, you know, his way of saying you're okay.
Mm. So like you grew up in more the 70s.
Yeah.
And during that time, what was Australia's relationship with gay people?
Oh, it was pretty bleak. You know, it was illegal. And I mean, weirdly enough, it wasn't ever, you know, because, you know, both my parents were dead. I didn't have, like a lot of Asian people have huge issues with family coming out, you know, for gay, lesbian Asian people. The biggest issue is a conservative family. I didn't have to deal with that because, you know, like both my parents were dead. And so I had this kind of liberal sort of, you know, not liberal, like, you know, progressive liberal history teacher who was cool and... So, weirdly enough, it wasn't that much of an issue. And then I told my sister about it and she freaked out for about an hour and then she got over it and it was fine. So, coming out was never a big deal for me, but at the time it was for a lot of people around me. You know, like I could see, I intuitively knew that it was not a good thing to be gay. But I guess the other thing was that I'd had so many dramas in my life by the time I was, you know, 16, 17. Mm. Honestly, coming out was very, very small. It was no big deal, yeah.
And I guess in some ways, which offered you some protection, I think, you know, you meeting Michael, the two of you could live in a bubble of normality.
Well, we were students in Canberra together, you know, so I mean we didn't even have any gay friends, like really, you know, all of our friends were the feminists on campus. I probably didn't explore the gay world until much later, probably my late 20s, when we ended up at one stage. I ended up going to, in my late 20s, I lived in Sydney. I went to film school in Sydney and started going to Mardi Gras and parties, and you know, and that was when I kind of saw and explored the gay world more. And
yeah, understood sort of gay culture here in Australia during that
time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that honestly for me, I didn't have a huge issue being gay, like, you know, and I didn't have profound issues of dealing with being Chinese in the white world. But I think being gay and Chinese was probably the hardest thing that I had to deal with in my 20s. Because I think that, you know, I wrote a piece recently in a book about actually my most profound experiences of racism was in the gay world. And that was such an eye-opener for me. Like, I was kind of shocked because, you know, like, you know, I'd had, you know, bogan guys shouting out things in cars as I walked down the street when I was a kid in Perth. But it really, you know, it did no damage. I didn't want their approval. I didn't want them to like me. I had no interest in them. Whereas in the gay world, you know, like when I first came out and, you know, and started meeting other gay men, I kind of wanted them to like me. I wanted their approval, you know, and I found that I was being judged in a way based on how I looked, in a way in which I hadn't recognized before. It was quite a shock.
Isn't it strange to think, though, that it's still just as prevalent today?
I didn't know whether it's still like that. I had hoped that it's changed or it's changing.
I think that it is changing, and I think that we need to open that conversation up and say no to what is out there. Like, if you look at these dating websites, I haven't been on a dating website in 9 years, so you can't really ask me.
Yeah.
But I do have that conversation with my multicultural friends, and it's disturbing to me that they have no Asians or no femmes. Or
I read about that on Facebook. I think that, you know, the advent of the app world has absolutely led to a much more brutal form of behavior amongst, you know. And the thing to remember about the gay male world is, you know, we're gay, but we're men as well. And men are, you know, are traditionally pretty f***ed up about emotional things. And, you know, and don't, you know, I think that collision can also not necessarily lead to the kindest behavior sometimes.
No, I think that men sometimes don't express themselves correctly.
Or kindly, yeah.
Moving away from that, though, and talking more about you and your next step. So what makes a good filmmaker? Like, what sets you apart from other people?
I think it was all this stuff had happened to me when I was a kid. Mm. And I just started writing it down, you know, in a way to process it. Yeah. And then I started showing people and you know, and I started writing scripts about it. And people really responded to the way I wrote and the way I told the story, and possibly because, you know, I told it in a way which was not about feeling sorry about for yourself or being a victim. It was just kind of pretty, this happened and, you know, wow, that's amazing that this happened, but isn't it sad that this happened? And people were affected by the way I told the story.
Well, I think there's an intensity and there's a truth in the way that you tell stories, which in some ways can be incredible, it can be brutal, but it can also be beautiful, which I found in some, like even in Walking on Water, I was watching that, and it was, I felt at some points that I was like, this film is incredibly disturbing.
Yeah.
But then I also kept looking at some of the cinematography or the writing or the way the actors said things.
Yeah.
And I was like, there's something kind of beautiful about this as well.
Yeah. And also, you know, we were always looking, you know, Roger and I, when we were making the film, we were always looking for the really human moments in an intense situation. So we kind of always called it, I mean, I don't think it's exactly right, but we called it a comedy about grief.
Wow.
It was about, you know, the weird, funny things that happen as well when people are going through an intense experience. And I had an understanding of that because of my childhood. Roger had an understanding of that because of his experience as a gay man through that time and losing really close friends. And so we both understood what we were looking for in making that film.
And I think what people don't know is that you had a really strong relationship with Tim Conagrave, who wrote
Holding the Man.
How did you know Tim? Like, how did you have that relationship?
I met Tim through a mutual friend called Kevin Jackson, who used to teach drama at NIDA, and Kevin was his drama teacher. And I got some money to do a short film called A Night Out with the Boys based on a short story I wrote. And so I was just doing the scene, and Kevin suggested I cast Tim. So I cast Tim into this, and we filmed it, and he was just a beautiful actor, and we became friends. But it was interesting. I met Tim after John had died. So I never knew John. And Tim had moved to Sydney and was working at the AIDS Council as a youth worker. And he was trying to find his life again without the love of his life. And so I didn't know about John, and he never talked about John. It was kind of interesting. So we became really close friends, and then he started writing the the book, and he started talking to me about the book, and then he started getting sick. And in the last few years of his life, we particularly bonded, you know, because I was a writer, director, sort of semi-unemployed. I had time on my hands. You know, we used to go to theatre together or to art galleries or just for walks. And he was talking about the book, and I remember he finally finished the manuscript two nights before he died, and he printed it out, and I've still got it. I've got the original copy of the book on blue paper in a binder, and he gave it to me, and I read it overnight, and I was just so moved because it was a whole world that I didn't really know about, but it was my friend, so I recognized his voice, and he was very funny, very sarcastic, very dry.
And a lot of that came across.
Oh, yeah. The character in the book is Tim. And so I read it overnight, and I was just absolutely a sobbing mess. And I went to see him the next day, and I wanted to talk to him about how much I loved it and how much I appreciated him showing me the book. And he had toxoplasmosis, and basically he had developed dementia overnight.
Oh, my God.
But I told him I wanted to make a film of the book, and he said, fabulous. But as it turns out, I couldn't do it. You know, like
I'd read that. I remember reading the story about you spending, I think, up to 4 years trying to write this book. But when something's so personal like that, you had difficulty culling it down.
It was a lesson in what not to do. So I just didn't... One, I didn't know what I was doing. And two, because he was my friend, I felt beholden to tell the truth.
What a powerful thing to learn, and also such a relatable thing for so many people, because that book in Australia, in the queer community, like, it's so recognisable.
Yeah, kind of like a cross between a fairy tale and an opera. It's a fairy tale because it's, you know, it's a love story between these two boys, and it's an opera because it ends tragically.
You know what's quite interesting about that particular story is how many different versions of a reaction I did manage to have from that. Like, the book in particular, the play... but also the film. Were you happy with these
tellings? I was, you know, a bawling mess every time I saw it.
Okay.
I think that Tommy Murphy just did an extraordinary job. And I mean, I guess because he's another generation, he's a younger generation, he was closer to the generation of the kids in the book. And I think he really captured something in that experience. And he distilled it down to what you need to do when you're making a drama, which is to, you know, the bare essence or the bare bones of the story. But he did it so beautifully and artfully, you know, like I'm full of admiration for it.
You then went on to tell the home song stories, which is what we were discussing. How much of what was left in the film is actually what happened?
Pretty much. I actually cut out more dramatic stuff that happened because it was just too unbelievable. So everything that kind of happened in the film actually happened in real life. It was pretty full on. It was a pretty full on time, particularly for my sister. And the story of the film is the story of how the mother takes on a lover and the lover falls in love with her daughter, you know, and that actually happened.
Well, your sister married him, didn't she?
No. Oh. No. My sister ended up marrying my history teacher.
Okay, the penny's just dropped.
That's a story, okay. You know, that's her story.
That's her story to tell, but sometimes it's starting to feel like, Tony, with your story, it's like the Star Wars universe. There's just a lot of characters, well, and they're all intertwined.
You know, you have a story to tell, and you so then you become a storyteller because you've told the story.
Interestingly enough, from all of that, did you go and watch the movie when it premiered with your sister? Were you with her when she watched it?
Oh, yeah. She was very involved in the whole thing because as much as it was my story, I was, you know, the kid in the film is an observer and he observes his sister's story. You know, that's the film.
Yeah.
And he observes his mother's story. And so it was very important that she know exactly what the film was about, and I had to get her permission to tell her story. What's hilarious is that, you know, siblings have different memories of the past. Mm. And, you know, we have very different memories of our mother, of what happened, you know, in the past, except for certain key things that happened in the film. But after the film, she started talking about things that happened in the film as though they were really things that happened in the past. And they were just little things that I'd actually dramatized to make more convenient, or I'd cut this or you know, change times or change locations. And she started talking about it as though it actually happened.
And
so
what did you say? Did you go, hang on a sec?
Yeah. No, I made that up.
My siblings sometimes say that to me. They're like, Ben, did that really happen? But I think there's your truth, and then there's your sibling's truth, and there's the what's actually happened. Because I think in lots of times, what I believe to be true is so true to me.
Yeah.
But because my brother has a different telling of that story, he probably jars against it and goes, come on.
But also, I mean, there are really interesting theories about memory now anyway, that, you know, like memory is not this thing, concrete thing that you recall, but actually it is, you know, a story that you reinvent every time you tell it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So the past is a series of contestation. It's fluid, you know.
Absolutely. But I mean, I think all of this as well, like, you've been so lucky to be able to express yourself in this way. I mean, you could have been quite terrified of all of this and shut down, but instead you're sort of navigating your way through your own story and your own truth.
Yeah, I kind of used art to help me not be a basket case. I mean, I sort of am a basket case anyway, but
I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah, but art sort of helped me just navigate the real things that happened in my life. And then probably from there, I just used the skills I acquired through being able to tell these very personal stories and started to apply them to other people's stories and, you know, other kinds of subjects.
Did you go and do the research? I mean, you were saying earlier that you went back to where you were born.
To Macau, yeah.
So did you learn things that you didn't know by doing the research?
Yeah. And then I sort of, you know, like I made a documentary called Sadness about William Yang, and that was his story. And so I kind of developed a process by which I work, and it's pretty much the same process that I work to this day, which is to always try to ground things in the truth, in what really happened. I made documentaries for a decade as well. I tried to make things
about real people.
Yeah, that felt real. And then even when I started moving into high concept areas like Glitch or Nowhere Boys, you know, that sort of, you know, fantasy stuff that I do these days, and which, you know, I love watching.
But see, to me, I think that shows who you were as a child. When I watched Nowhere Boys, I watched all four seasons over 2 days. three seasons, because the fourth one's not out yet.
Yeah.
But I thought when watching Nowhere Boys and with watching Glitch, I imagined that there was a large part of you growing up where you existed in a fantasy world.
Gee, you're like my analyst. It's insane. That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. I used to collect comic books from the age of 8. I've got about 5,000 in my roof to this day, comic books. And I used to basically to get to sleep at night. I think because I held so much trauma in my body. You know, that was my way of, you know, like, you know, mentally I was pretty agile, but physically, you know, like there was a lot of the way I processed trauma was it just went straight into my body. So I used to tuck myself into a doona and I used to just tell myself a story, you know, and either it was a superhero story or a magic story or, you know, so I used to, that was basically how I got to sleep at night.
Well, it's like working out a muscle.
Right? Yeah. And it's that same kind of muscle that I sort of use to this day, you know, in trying to create those stories. But what I was going to say is that even in working in those genres, like when we did Nowhere Boys, the first thing I did was get a whole bunch of research commissioned about the multiverse and quantum physics and Lorentzian wormholes and, you know, like stuff like that. Because I sort of thought, well, if I'm going to take a high concept, it has to be, you know, you have to really examine it and try to find the truth behind it.
Absolutely. Yep. But I think there's a lot of respect to the kids that are going to watch that show in the sense that it's very relatable and they're real characters. They're real people. I mean, it seemed to me like you'd lived a lot of these lives.
Yep.
But as children, we'd love to have superpowers.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd love to be exploring that. But I think for children, we love to think that we're important. And you tell stories about these kids in a very clever way because they're fully developed characters.
You know, the irony is that the Chinese boy in Nowhere Boys was the same kid who played me in Homesong Stories.
Do you have a lot of people you work with ringing you up saying, Tony, I want to be in another one of your stories? then you started to develop a relationship shortly after these films with working more with television.
Yeah.
You did Bogan Pride with Rebel Wilson.
Yes, that's right.
What was it like? And did you have a sense when you were working with Rebel Wilson that she was going to go on to be what she is now?
I always knew that Rebel was going to be a star. Rebel had it all. She was so determined. She was such a hard worker. She was a really good writer. I mean, I knew her when she was just still doing sketch comedy.
Yeah.
So, you know, like basically I was trying to help her go from sketch comedy into longer form narrative. And so, you know, so I worked as a script editor and then we, you know, produced the show together and she starred in it. And yeah, I, you know, even back then you knew that she had all of the talent and the determination to do very well. And, you know, I'm not surprised she's done as well as she has, but she also knows how to navigate that world. Like, she was very determined, and I think that's...
Well, you've got to be.
Yeah. I admire her for that.
It can be a very dangerous place to navigate. So then you came across The Slap, which was one of my favourite books of all time, and Christos Tsolkas is just amazing.
Yeah.
How did you know that was going to work better as a TV show rather than a film? Because I remember Christos before you did it.
Yeah.
He was passionate about making it a film.
He's a cinephile, yeah. Well, basically, I sort of pitched to him that, you know, when I read it, I just thought, if you turn it into a film, it's pretty much going to be about the court case. That's all it's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, about someone hits someone else's kid, that person's so outraged, they take them to court, and then, you know, their friends split up over it. But, you know, it was going to be reduced because that's what films are. They're always reduced. The thing that's most interesting about The Slap is actually not the slap itself. Mm. It's about everything else that happens around it, the repercussions, the way it sort of tears away the veil of civility that holds us all together, you know, that has, you know, been torn away pretty dramatically these days. But, you know, it just shows you how starkly different people are in underneath. And for me, that was what was interesting about it. So to do it as a TV series felt like you could really honour the book. I mean, so that was my pitch. And, you know, thankfully Christos
agreed
with it.
Yeah. Brendan Cowell, how did you get him involved?
He wanted to write it, and Brendan's, you know, larger than life character. He's hilarious, and you know, and he wrote the Harry chapter, it was great, you know, and then he wrote the Richie chapter, and I thought, you know, this is Brendan. It's the combination of the big machismo man and the gay teenage boy, and I thought that sort of describes Brendan. You know, he's very innocent in some ways and very alpha male in other ways. And then whilst we were working on it, I just thought, oh, you should play Richie's dad.
But I mean, there was also, when I watched The Slap on TV for the first time, it did have some things that reminded me of Love My Way, some real honesty about who we are in Australia, in suburbia Australia. Like, that retelling, I thought, lifted from what was written in the book by Christos and came across on screen, I think, from some of that writing.
I mean, we all loved the book so much. You know, even though there were things that in the series that changed from the book, whenever we were stuck dramatically, we're trying to work out what would happen, we always went back to the book and the answers were in the book. It was kind of like the Bible. It was weird.
Well, you do. I think that's what happens when you're trying to translate something, is you're only looking to tell the truth of the book.
Yeah.
And if you go back to that truth, you then can find the narrative.
It was such a strong source material.
And then did you say to Christos at that time, are you writing Barracuda? You haven't given it to me?
I knew that he was writing Barracuda and I wanted to read it. Yeah. And as soon as I read it, you know, I'm a terrible reader. So I always read things really late.
Yeah. Don't you read only 3 books a year?
Oh, shocking. I'm shocking. I wish I was better. But, you know, I was late to read it because initially, you know, I heard that, you know, maybe it would be hard to translate. As soon as I read it, I knew exactly what I thought we should do with it. And I pitched it to him. I said, you know, Barracuda as a book was about a whole life. But for me, I just want to tell the story of 4 years in this guy's life. And I pitched it to Christos. We had a great relationship because of The Slap, you know, and because he's a mate.
Mm.
And he said, yeah, okay, that sounds good. Give it a go. And then I went and pitched at the ABC, and they loved the pitch and said, yeah, you know, this is very brave of them, because it was the year of the Olympics, and they said, we want to do a story that about someone that about not always winning.
Mm.
I mean, Barracuda is about someone coming to terms with failure, you know, and that's a big theme that we don't talk about very often.
Not at all.
Yeah. And I thought that was why I wanted to make it. And that was also why the ABC wanted to get behind it as well.
I think sometimes those stories don't get told because for years we're sort of told, oh, they're too sad or they're too bleak. And so we don't want to unearth that because people don't need to be reveling in sadness. But for me, that's what I'm drawn to that in particular.
You know, I loved, you know what, particularly the writers, Belinda Chaco and Blake Ashford and the director, Rob Connolly, and producer, Amanda Higgs, you know, like my collaborators on that project. I loved the ultimate show that was made from it. I just thought it was, you know, like I say, I think I'm a humanist. I love things that can connect us as human beings.
Yeah.
That can actually sort of speak to people and you know, make people feel things. You know, they're the things that I like watching and certainly the things I like making.
How did Matchbox Pictures come about?
Matchbox came about when Michael and I had a company called Big and Little Films.
Yep.
And it was doing pretty well, but it was just the two of us. And back then, I just had this sense that we either had to get bigger or smaller. There was two of us and we had two employees and, you know, it was a tiny little unit. And we talked to a number of people about, you know, are you interested in joining forces? And eventually we joined forces with a very dear friend of ours, Penny Chapman, who gave me my first job out of film school. And she's a legend. She was the head of drama at the ABC. She was head of television at the ABC. She's this incredible producer. And so we formed a company with her and we brought in a couple of other producers, really amazing producers, Helen Bowden, Helen Pankhurst. And the five of us decided, well, we'll just give it a go, see what happens. And we got a business consultant in. And then the rest is history. It took off. It just was so successful. And then a couple of years into it, NBC Universal approached us and wanted to invest in the company with the aim of eventually buying the company, which happened. And, you know, it was just tremendously successful venture, and you know, I was there for 10 years.
Was there a direct plan about the tapestry of what Matchbox was doing with storytelling? I mean, you've got the Real Housewives of Melbourne, which is like a guilty pleasure.
Yeah,
you know, it's absolutely watching people be people, good and bad, which I kind of liked. As I said, guilty pleasure. But then you also had Nowhere Boys, you had something for younger people, you had something for older people. I mean, Glitch, for me, and I guess I understand death because I've lost people in my life, but I watched Glitch that first season thinking, oh my God, imagine if these people come back from the dead and how would you be?
Yeah.
But it was a real tapestry of what Matchbox did. Were you coordinating that?
A lot of the first content of Matchbox were my original ideas, or Penny generated a lot of stuff as well. It was pretty organized chaos, I guess you would call it. Matchbox did a lot of work which was about representing people who don't get seen on screen. You know, like that became, we were ahead of the diversity wave. You know, like the early work that we did was all about representation. That was part of the passion of the storytelling, because I think that we felt that we were telling stories that weren't being seen. You know, everyone was working really hard, you know, like, and then the company became this magnet for talent. Like, all these amazing people started working in the company. And, you know, and then the company was also really great at developing people. So, you know, someone would come from get a job as the front of house, and then, you know, a couple of years later, they're running their own shows or winning Emmys or, you know, like that. There was a real sort of trajectory for people in the company.
But also a sense of family and respect.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think that's what, if I know anyone that's ever had anything to do with Matchbox, that's what they always say. You know, there's a lot of respect for the different projects, you know.
Yeah.
Some projects might not be everyone's cup of tea, but
exactly.
You know, in family, you know, you go and sit there at Christmas dinner and sort of share your stories, and that's ultimately what you've been doing.
Yeah. It's a very nurturing environment, you know, like I think that, you know, and really proud of that. And you know, but I left Matchbox at the beginning of the year and sort of decided to.
Well, you've got
try
Tap.
Something else. Yes, it's called Tap. Yes,
which I thought was a great name. Do you want to explain to everyone what Tap is?
Tony Ayres Production.
There you go.
But Tap is a much better acronym.
Well, I kind of like the mantra that you're having for this, where, you know, you're wanting to go out and tell high-level productions of scripted drama,
yeah,
which was representing diversity.
I'm working on a whole bunch of really interesting things with a whole bunch of really interesting people. So
there's got to be a lot of stories that are going to be coming out of that.
Yeah, yeah. There's going to be a couple of announcements in the next few months, which I think are going to be pretty exciting.
Who were your idols growing up? Like, who were your inspiration? When you were growing up, who were the people that you thought... Because it's hard for us, if you're talking to a lot of queer people, there, when we were growing up, there really wasn't a lot of queer representation.
No.
So we don't have that to look up to. Who were your idols?
I mean, the filmmakers I loved were American filmmakers, you know, like from that indie period. I loved Mike Nichols, who did The Graduate. I loved Robert Altman, you know, all of those kind of insane, bold films. So I guess in terms of gay filmmakers and writers, there weren't that many to sort of, you know, lead the way. One person who had a profound effect on my career was a playwright called Nick Enright, but he wrote Lorenzo's Oil. He got nominated for an Oscar for Lorenzo's Oil. He was very generous, and he showed me that you could actually be successful and not an asshole. Like, you could be a good, decent person. And I always thought that's just the most important ambition to have, you know, like to be a decent person, you know, to work hard and to, you know, try to do your best in your work, but then to treat people well as well. That's the side of ambition you don't hear a lot about. Especially in our industry, there's this kind of myth that you have to be a little bit ruthless, you have to be a little bit cutthroat, and I don't believe that.
Well, the interesting thing of this is that you will probably be who filmmakers look up to. So you're actually someone who's in the queer space that's doing something amazing, which they will look up to. And isn't it great that you value that? Because we may see another generation of people who don't go out there being assholes.
I hope so. Yeah,
enjoy doing what they do.
I mean, it's always weird when you still carry the version of yourself you have when you're a kid, which is, you know, I'm just this guy's trying to make a living, you know, like I'm trying to do okay. And I know that that's not true, because I know I've had successes. But I think that you have to be wary of your own press. You have to be very careful of not being too entitled.
Absolutely. But I think also you've been able to rope a lot of people into that who obviously value the same thing. Benjamin Law's been on the show and talked to him a lot about you.
Yeah,
and
well, Ben is, you know, he's the future. You know, he's amazing.
I just sat there reading all the things that he's done, much like yourself.
Phenomenal.
And you're like,
phenomenal.
Oh, you're writing a... who's writing a show for Channel 10 and working for the MTC, but also getting published in every newspaper
and
magazine?
Yes, and doing a radio show and doing a TV show.
And also being very humble about it and present.
I think the closeness of his family, you know, you can see that's where it comes from.
Can you tell us what we can expect to see from The Family Law Season 3, which is, you know, imminent?
Well, I'll just say it's the gayest season yet.
We're going to find out how Ben comes out.
Yeah. It's the coming out season. I also think about the thing I think about Family Law is I think it's about a family and they just happen to be Chinese. I mean, it's integral to it, but it's not what the show is about. The show is just about this dysfunctional family, this mother who's trying to find her identity, trying to find her vagina.
And she's going to talk about it.
Yeah. And it's very relatable. You know, that's the thing. You know, weirdly enough, it could be on Channel 10, it could be on Channel 9. But fortunately for us, it's on SBS because they've let us make the show that we want to make.
Yeah. Can we talk about what's coming up next for you?
Season 3 of Glitch is coming up. Season 4 of Nowhere Boys is coming up.
December. Is that right?
December season 4 of Nowhere Boys. Season 3 Glitch is next year sometime. I don't think it's got a date yet. And then, you know, like I just have to tease because I can't say, but there are a couple of things that are coming up which I think will be super exciting. A passion project that I've been working on for a long time and that looks like it's going to happen, and then something international which looks like it's going to happen. So I'm kind of excited.
Well, I'm excited about you telling stories.
Yeah.
outside of Australia as well as about Australians. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, no, it feels like the right thing to do right now.
Have you got a message for the queer community that might be listening to this up right now?
I feel like it is a time that's where it's important to actually build bridges and mend divisions. I think you see it happening in America, and I sort of watch it like the same way that you watch a car crash or Real Housewives. You know, you can't take your eyes off it. So kind of appalling. But I feel like that shadow is coming to Australia. I think that the conservative politicians are learning lessons from the success of people like Trump. And I think that, you know, what's important for us as a community is to understand tolerance and to be able to reach out to people who don't speak the same language as us, and to be able to communicate to other people. You know, like I feel like, you know, for all of us at the moment, that's an important thing to be doing.
Well, I think with marriage equality and what happened with that, there was a real sense of community and getting together and supporting one another to getting something done, which is about inclusion.
Yeah, but it was also, you know, one of the tactics was to go out and talk to people. And I think that, you know, that's kind of what we need to do. We need to kind of get off Twitter and Grindr, you know, and actually just talk to each other.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for coming in and joining us on Word for Word.
Yeah, I hope I didn't overshare.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Ben Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.